Welcome to a La Trobe University podcast. I'd be your host, Matt Smith, and this is a frog. Now I know what you're thinking. It's a La Trobe University podcast. There's a frog. We've got the Blue Danube playing in the background. Any minute now, this little green sucker's going to be airborne. But not this time. Today, we'll be talking with Dr. Richard Wassersug of the Department of Anatomy and Neurobiology at Dalhousie University. He spent his career studying frogs and tadpoles, so for now, we'll hold on to the little guy.
I've been in the science game for quite some time. When I was in high school, the Russians had launched Sputnik. The Americans felt they're way behind in a space race, and they started funding high school students to do research or be associated with labs, not just to do it on their own, but to actually get a chance to work in a real research lab. And I was a part of a program like that. I worked at Harvard University on a fossil toad, published my first paper on this fossil toad back in the 19th somewhere. Back then, it got me very much interested in the evolution of frogs. All through university and on to graduate school, I realized that there was a fascinating problem with the evolution of frogs. If you were to lay out, just as a comparative example, insectivorous mammals, monkeys, higher primates, humans, you can get an actual progression that makes good sense. You can look at a frog, the first one we get in the fossil record, it looks like a frog. And then you look at anything before it, it looks like a salamander. There's nothing in between. Mm. So we didn't know where the frogs came from and how they were built. I got into graduate school and I realized that any answer I came up with about the evolution of frogs would also have to explain the evolution of tadpoles. And nobody was really looking at tadpoles. So I started studying tadpoles. First I studied their morphology, and ones would have very funny, very complicated structures inside their mouths. Even though they looked so simple, right, a little round body with a tail, inside their mouths there were all sorts of fancy particles separating papillae and ridges and so forth. And that became the beginning of my career. Some of them, some of these strange structures, also had strange behaviors. So I started studying their behavior. And then I realized that those that had that strange behavior, the amount of oxygen in the water changed their behavior. So I started studying their oxygen responses and their physiology. And I spent most of my career studying, I think I published about 150 or more papers on the biology of tadpoles, trying to understand these animals. It's been great fun because I've had freedom to study every aspect, their behavior, their ecology, their morphology, physiology, and so forth.
Are they as diverse as the frogs? And can you kind of get an indication, if you look at a tadpole, what sort of frog or toad you're going to get?
Sometimes you can and sometimes you can't. Most of the time, pretty simple on the externally, but if you open them up and look inside their mouths, it turns out they're very complicated. My colleagues and I have done things like used high-speed cameras to try to figure out how they can feed. Some tadpoles can extract from water virus-sized particles. And this is a remarkable filter feeding capability. It was questions like that that really started my interest. And there are certain families of frogs which have very specific types of tadpoles. So in that situation, if you found the tadpole, you'd know what family of frogs it belonged to, and you could pretty well guess what that tadpole would turn into. Often, to this day, in museums, there's lots of collections of unidentified tadpoles where they found the tadpoles, but they never found a frog or never raised the tadpoles long enough to find out what frog they turned into. So we still have a fair bit of work for those who are interested, and a group of organisms that are still fairly unstudied to figure out what some of the tadpoles are, matching them to the adult frogs.
You were awarded an Ig Nobel Prize for research involving tadpoles. Can you tell me a bit about that? It was 30 years after you published the paper, wasn't it?
Yes, it was.
So it must come as a bit of a surprise.
Yes, it came up as a bit of a surprise because, frankly, I thought there were lots of better studies in those 30 years worthy of an Ig Nobel Prize. So the Ig Nobel Prizes were satirical and generally critically satirical awards given out every year. A guy who runs this program out of Harvard is a guy named Mark Abrams. He also publishes the Annals of Improbable Research, a science humor magazine. Early on, this is the way it's phrased, either research that couldn't or shouldn't be duplicated. It was making fun of research that was pretty bad, or perhaps even dangerous. I have to say, regrettably, but I guess I should acknowledge this, my research is of the school that shouldn't be duplicated, but could be duplicated, but shouldn't be. Because in fact, as I look back now, I realize it was pretty dangerous what I did. But I was in a tropical biology class in the jungle in Costa Rica for a two-month course. And at the end of the course, we had 3 days of an independent study program. And one of the things I realized is that some of the tadpoles were real easy to see, find, and collect. Real easy. And if they're real easy for me to see, find, and collect, one might imagine they'd be real easy for birds and other animals to see, find, and collect. And I thought if they're going to survive, they probably would taste terrible. And then there were other tadpoles that lived individually under rocks and fast-flowing streams, where you'd stand in the stream with a special net, roll over a rock, and you were lucky if you could catch one tadpole in an hour. And I thought, well, they can hide. They're cryptic. They're hard to find. Maybe they taste differently. The only catch was, how do I find a predator that would eat tadpoles on the spur of the moment? So I went for the easiest conditioned organism I could find, which were my fellow graduate students. And with a bribe of beer, an embarrassment there as well, I got them to join in a tadpole tasting project with me. And indeed, the tadpoles that were easy to find tasted terrible. They are the worst tasting tadpoles in the world. And there's actually an Australian edge to this, because they turn out to be Bufa marinus, the cane toad. That's the invasive toad that has taken over territory in Australia, partially because the tadpoles and the adults taste so bad that nobody eats them. So I wrote this paper up, and 30 years later, I got myself an Ig Nobel Prize. I would like to say, in my own defense, I didn't just file a human ethics. I mean, nowadays I wouldn't have done the study. This is too risky. We didn't swallow them, by the way. I had people spit them out. But the toad tadpoles, the cane toad tadpoles, were the most bitter thing I've ever tasted in my whole life. They are terrible.
Also, in your defense, self-experimentation isn't exactly new.
Many people have done, in fact, self-experimentation, and some Nobel Prizes have been won for people who had the courage to do this type of stuff. The first person to do imaging of a catheterization of the heart, put a dye into the heart, actually ran the line up his own arm and stood in front of this x-ray machine and got a Nobel Prize for that. I appreciated that mindset of self-experimentation, and I think I do respect that. But at the same time, that was a dangerous experiment. Now, I might say that, if I can, a little more about the Ig Nobel Prizes. They've changed their theme. Over the years, they've become much more interested in research that is not stupid or evil or shouldn't be reproduced. But what the NALA slogan is, it's research that first makes you laugh and then makes you think. And I think that's a much better slogan. And then what's happened also over the years is that it's been 10 years since I won that award, but the Ig Nobel Prizes have become a fair bit more respectable, particularly because of one gentleman who won one when I was there. He won the physics one. His name was André Geim. And last year, he won a Nobel Prize. It takes some creativity to both do wacko science and do useful wacko science, but you still have to be a bit creative. And I think the awards now are going to creativity. And I'm sort of proud that I pulled this off and actually got a publishable paper with less than 3 days of work.
What sort of work are you doing with tadpoles now? Do they get much of a look in?
Yes, I am still working with tadpoles. We have one paper in press that I published three or four last year. And they're all related to another and very serious problem affecting tadpoles. Unfortunately, these animals that I love and have studied for so long in so many places in the world are now dying off. And dying off not just in terms of a few in a single species, but species and genera and whole communities, multi-species communities are disappearing. There are a variety of reasons why. We don't know what the primary one is. But one of them involves a fungal infection that affects the mouth parts of tadpoles. Well, I started my research on tadpoles way back when, looking at the mouth parts. So we're interested in how, and I've been publishing on, how these mouth parts actually work when they're affected by this fungus, and whether the fungus attacking the mouth parts is really what's killing off the tadpoles, because the fungus could also be affecting internally the other organs, and therefore its lethality may be related to that. And one of the things we've shown is that, in fact, it is simply the damage they do to the mouth parts that is the most serious hit to the tadpoles. And now, how you control this fungus and all that, we don't know. What this has led us to do is use high-speed video imaging of the mouth parts and actually study the details at 500 frames a second. This is high speed, to look at how they use these very, very complicated little structures in order to scrape food off of surfaces and so forth. And they do it fast and they do it elegantly. As simple as they are and as mindless as they appear to be, they turn out to have very elaborate and elegant feeding structures and feeding behaviors. And understanding that may hopefully somehow help us understand ways of perhaps protecting them from disappearing, or at least knowing what foods are best for them and so forth. So all of my work with tadpoles right now tends to be focused on that. We also have one odd study that I did, which was looking at the shape of the aquatic environment that tadpoles are raised in. So we built aquaria, which were a truncated frustra. They were a pyramid with a top cut off, and this way, by changing the slope of the sides, we could keep the water depth the same, or the water surface area the same, or the volume the same, and keep two of the three variables the same while changing only one. Then we could ask whether it mattered, for instance, if you raised tadpoles in two groups, the same volume of water but different depths, or the same volume of water, same depth but different surface areas, whether that made a difference. We found there, as an example, tadpoles that live in large bodies of water suffer in shallow water because of the depth and not because of the volume. They have a problem reaching the surface and taking a bite of air when they're air breathers, which they can't do if the water is too shallow. And this has ecological implications because we're concerned about global climate change leading to ponds drying. And what this study suggests is the ponds don't even have to dry up fully to put the tadpoles in jeopardy. And in fact, they don't even have to get overheated, or they don't have to have a decline in their oxygen. Just by lowering the depth of the water, the tadpoles will be in trouble. So this has real ecological implications. And I'm concerned about that. I haven't given up working on tadpoles and hope to continue working a bit more with them in the future.
That's all the time we've got for the La Trobe University podcast today. If you have any questions, comments or feedback, you can send us an email at podcast@latrobe.edu.au. Dr. Richard Wassersug, thank you for your time.
You're welcome. Thank you very much.